Hey, Static Void podcast listeners, before we get into the show, I want to tell you about a new developer conference in the Northeast U.S. called Tech Bash. It's happening September 28th to 30th at the Kalahari Indoor Water Park and Resort in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, just under a two-hour drive from both Philadelphia and New York City, and totally drivable from Boston and Washington, D.C. too. Keynotes from Pete Brown and Glenn Block will be kicking things off and setting the tone for 40 world-class speakers, including Jeff Fritz from this very episode, who will be presenting on a variety of topics such as .NET Core, Xamarin, Azure, Docker, TypeScript, AngularJS, and Aurelia, as well as some more general sessions on concepts like Agile, DevOps, open source development, application security, and more. And if that's not enough for you, when you stay at the resort using the discounted rate of $159 per night, everyone in your room gets free access to the water park. So, come for the presentations, stay for the slides. Go to techbash.com to register, but act fast because registration ends soon.
Developers, 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 developers. Developers, 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 developers.
Hello, and welcome to the Static Void podcast. I'm Jess Chadwick.
I'm Todd Slater.
And I'm Chris Gomez.
And we are your hosts. We're recording this on the evening of July 27th, 2016. And in this episode, we're going to be continuing on with our series of episodes on .NET Core and ASP.NET Core. And tonight, we actually have a special guest, Jeff Fritz. So Jeffrey T. Fritz is a senior program manager in Microsoft's development division on the ASP.NET team. As a longtime web developer with experience in large and small applications in several different industries, he knows how to build for performance and practicality. You can also learn from Jeffrey on Pluralsight, Wintellect, follow him on Twitter at C#Fritz, and read his blogs at jeffreyfritz.com and blogs.msdn.com/webdev. So Jeff, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's going to be fun to be here and chat with you for a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. So you actually kind of reached out to me after the last show and said, hey, I was screaming at my radio on the way to the airport, right? So I said, come on, let's talk about it. So I, in particular, was particularly rough about ASP.NET Core and kind of .NET Core in general. And so I'm really glad that you're able to come onto the show and kind of talk about it from representing kind of Microsoft's point of view, because I'm coming at it from more of a, I'm kind of an experienced developer out there in the world, just kind of trying to make sense of all this stuff, not just learn it, but figure out like why, right? So I guess that's my biggest question is, this is a pretty significant change. So why am I really going to invest in learning this, and what am I going to get out of it?
Okay, so a couple of really good questions there, a couple of different points. So let's break that down. You're right. This is a big change. To be perfectly clear, in, over the past 3 years, Microsoft has completely rewritten ASP.NET and this new framework, the .NET Core framework, from the ground up. Brand new. Every line of code is fresh, just the way grandma used to bake it. But at the same time, we've still got 15 years of .NET overhead out there that's running very well in production spaces, and there are millions of web applications and desktop applications and WPF applications out there that are running great, right? Mm-hmm. Yep. So why build a new ASP.NET and .NET framework? Well, if you look at the 15-year history, we've actually been building several .NET frameworks. And I say we as an industry, because going back to, I think it's 2003, 2004, Miguel Diacaza started the Mono project, right? And we had a second .NET framework at that point, and it was one that was built on standards and not by Microsoft. And it was good. It served the needs for getting .NET running on Linux and eventually Mac and eventually iOS and Android, right? And then the Xamarin SDK happened. So we then have three .NET frameworks. Yeah. And then Silverlight also happened in that time, and we have a fourth framework. And then we said, you know what? We need a different framework for Windows Store apps. There's a sixth framework. And these guys over here wanting a framework so they could build games. They took that Mono GPL framework that Miguel and his team built, and they said, let's extend this and build games. Now we've got a seventh framework called Unity. Yep. So we've got all these very focused, very specialized .NET frameworks, seven of them out there. Mm-hmm. And what's one more? No. In all honesty, none of them really fits the needs for building that very focused server-side application that's really going to be doing communications over HTTP or some other protocol, but specifically HTTP in most cases. And it needs to, you know, be slim and deliver those angle brackets and curly braces that you need to run your web application. Mm-hmm. So that's what the original intent in ASP.NET Core was. Let's get something very thin, completely modular, and make this work. And you know what? If our folks out there, our customers are saying, hey, I want to run on other environments. I want to be able to collaborate with my teammates that are on a Mac or Linux box and publish to Linux or use Docker containers. Well, okay, we need to make that new framework cross-platform.
Right.
And open source, well, that's the way Microsoft has actually been doing things, full open source, with taking back contributions now for a few years. Actually, Microsoft.net has been open source since the beginning with NDAs, not completely open source, but you could see mm-hmm. the source code, and you can actually see all the source code for the .NET 4 versions of the framework. They're available out there on the web. You can download them. But we wanted to bring the .NET frameworks and ASP.NET to where the developers were and give them all the tools they need to be productive in ways that were competitive to the other competing web frameworks. Right. So that was the thinking that led to the decision to build a new ASP.NET Core, to build a .NET Core framework. And then other things happened along the way. Business things, right? Big things. Acquiring Xamarin was a huge change. And having you know, Miguel Diakaza and his team that are brilliant technologists join the fold and have their expertise of how things run on Linux and Mac help feed that .NET Core ecosystem.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a win situation for everybody.
Yeah.
So now we can grow and use some of their tools and combine and make all of .NET better, not just on Linux and Mac. So that was some of the reasoning behind that. And when you really break it down, there's and some people have seen me present. You see, I talk about seven tenets of why ASP.NET Core happened, and I've covered them all here. They're the modularity, open source. We want to be able to build things quickly. Cross-platform, that's a big one you guys touched on, and absolutely, that's a tremendous thing.
Yeah.
The performance is huge, and you guys are right to start comparing performance to Node. So we're there. We've got a great framework that does these things. And then there's some other questions that you guys had that we should get into.
Right.
So if I'm an existing .NET developer, I'm an ASP.NET developer, and I have .NET 4.6, mm-hmm. Why would I want to switch to Core? What is the advantage I could get going to Core?
Sure. So that's the killer question, right? That's the million-dollar question is why do I want to go to Core? Now, Todd, there's two answers to that question, right? For existing applications, why do you want to take them to Core? The short-term answer is don't. It's a first RTM release. The migration strategy right now is a little bit bumpy. I've gone through migrating a couple of websites here over the past month, and it's not trivial. It's possible, but you're going to get there. You'll have the cross-platform capabilities. You'll have the performance available to you, and you'll have these additional capabilities that are released to you through NuGet packages that aren't there currently in the 4.6 and earlier cycle. Plus, you get all the container capabilities. You get easy migration to the cloud. There's a lot of pluses to going there, but it's still a 1.0 release versus something that's been tried and tested and hammered for 15 years. So my recommendation for a brownfield application is, you know what, for right now, don't look at migrating it. You have something that works really good there that we're still supporting, and there's a preview of a .NET 4.6.2 framework out there that's going to be released here this summer. You know what? Work with that, and you're going to have support for at least the next 10 years under the standard support contract. But if you're looking at a greenfield application, and you do want to start thinking about advanced JavaScript tooling and frameworks, right? You want to do something that's bleeding edge Angular or Aurelia and have a very rich API there that you can scale in the cloud very easily because you're using containers, you're deploying to Linux. You know what? Give it a try. Check out ASP.NET Core because it does all of those things really, really well.
Okay, cool. You addressed one of the questions I had was about what 4.6.2 was compared to 4.6.1. So if I'm going to stick to a Windows, right? Let's say I'm building a traditional line of business application, but I'm going to build a new one. Mm-hmm. Is the performance the reason why I want to go to Core, or is it I should wait until it matures a little bit more before switching over?
So you're building a new business application,
yeah.
A new ASP.NET application. Do you go 4.6.2 or do you go Core is your question. Right. And
basically, because we don't really need many of those seven tenets, I think, is what we're getting
sure.
at. Right?
So if you go with 4.6.2, that doesn't work in the new Windows containers that we've been demonstrating and talking about, because Windows containers run with the .NET Core framework because they're thinner and they run with Windows Nano.
Okay.
So we would still look at, right, big VMs. You'd be looking at web applications that work great, and they know how to deploy and manage that stuff, and you can continue using the same technology you know. I would stick with that.
And how much longer can we expect to see that? How much longer is the full framework going to live on? I know you said the 10-year support for
right.
what has already been released, and that will always be true for whatever is released next, but is there a concrete plan or a sunset, you know, a roadmap to sunset the full framework, or is there a specific plan to keep it going for a long time?
There are plans to continue the full framework through at least Visual Studio 15.
Mm-hmm.
Where my team, the ASP.NET Web Forms team, is building features and functionality for Visual Studio 15 right now. So.
Right.
I mean, I can absolutely confirm to you that there is another release of that coming. That's
right.
That, you know, everybody's seen the previews for Visual Studio 15. We're out to preview 4 right now, I think, is what's released. There's lots more coming. And yes, there's enhancements coming for that stuff. Of course, we have a new version of Windows coming next week or
right.
last week, depending on when you're listening to this.
yeah.
Right, Windows 10 Anniversary Edition. So there's new versions, a new version of the .NET framework that comes with that. That's the 4.6.2 framework you're going to see is going to
sure.
be available and work with that. But whenever there's a new version of Windows, there's enhancements and capabilities to the .NET framework that come along with that, the base class
sure.
library you get installed. So
right.
there's...
Because the .NET full framework is very much kind of tied to Windows. It is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which hence the support contract.
Exactly.
Right. So I'm definitely not looking for you to make the statement, you know, .NET full is dead, you know, but I think it's pretty fair to say that .NET Core is the next generation of .NET, right? I see it as the next generation. I think a lot of people would. And I guess that begs the question of how much longer can I expect the current generation to be around? And I'm not necessarily even asking for a specific time frame, just like, should I really start to think about migrating my applications? Even if right now, today, the answer is, continue to use full, it'll be around for the next 10 years. Should I be setting my sights shorter than 10 years to start migrating?
Really, when you look at your applications that you install with Project Centennial, right? If you've written a Windows Forms application or a WPF application, you can recompile it with Project Centennial, right? That's the adapter that'll recompile your apps for UWP,
right.
for the Windows Store.
Win32 apps to
gets
UWP,
it into that
right?
model. Yeah. Yep. So those UWP apps, when they get deployed from the store, that's .NET Core that they get compiled with, right? So we're already seeing that when you do migrate there, you're going to get .NET Core applications.
Right.
The .NET standard and defining this common API across these things, while a migration pattern from the PCL model that we had for the past few years, that very much gives us a roadmap for here's how we can start pointing to APIs and relating APIs between different versions of .NET and have common references across them.
That's so fair. Yeah.
So
the .NET standard makes that question matter less, I guess.
Exactly.
You don't
care that you're targeting full framework. You don't care that you're targeting iOS. You're targeting .NET standard 1.3. Great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's up to those frameworks that adhere to that standard to implement those APIs appropriately.
And, you know, we never got to .NET standard when we were talking. We got to the end of the show and said, boy, this is one of the bullet points we left out. But what does that mean as a developer? What am I looking for in the IDE? What do I look for in third-party support? How do I even know?
Right. This is the problem and the solution that we're deriving right now and why we only have preview versions of tooling. Because the concept of .NET standard and applying things to that standard is very, very new. And as that evolves, as we start to hone in and get all of our frameworks abiding by the standards that are in it, we're going to be able to make some assumptions and build some things out with the tooling to make it a heck of a lot easier to use. So one of the places that you'll see .NET standard referenced right now is on NuGet.org. You can look at packages there and it'll tell you what version of .NET standard the package depends on. Cool, but that still doesn't mean a whole lot more to the typical developer without going and consulting the .NET standard chart of frameworks and capabilities. So we need to simplify that. Point blank, we need to simplify that experience. There is a team working on that, and when the finished version of that tooling comes out, I fully expect it to be something that's a heck of a lot easier to comprehend and understand for the typical developer. But for now, just like I was saying a little while ago, where you do have developers out there that are seeing the changes committed to our source code, to Microsoft source code on GitHub, they're jumping on that source code and saying, this works great for me. We're seeing the same thing with folks. Some folks are jumping on .NET standard and saying, this works great for me, without having any documentation. But for this to be a true high-quality product, we need great tooling and we need great documentation behind it.
Yeah. So until that tooling is live, I'm going to want to print that chart out. Put it on my wall so I can refer to it.
You aren't kidding. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. We used to have to print out the big .NET library, the whole thing on your wall. We used to cover the wall. So you did it again.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. What happened to those posters?
They were cool, man. Right? You could make
it had like
wall.
A web API poster.
So, yeah, exactly. Originally, when ASP.NET Core was called 5, there was this idea that I could write core code or MC5 code, and then it could target both what was, I guess,
full
DNS
framework
at the time or full framework. Do I still have that experience? Because that's not clear to me now.
That tooling has been removed. The default templates now only target one version of the framework. And realistically, we looked at this and said, you know what? Nobody's really delivering to two different versions of the framework. They're delivering to one.
Right.
It was difficult to manage. It was confusing to explain to folks that, we're actually compiling twice. It was something that, you know what, we needed to back off on, make it simpler, make it same metaphor that you were used to in Visual Studio. So those of us who were in on the previews and really enjoyed seeing some of that and thought that was interesting, it wasn't as productive as we thought it could be.
Okay. Yeah, I had a pretty good understanding of it and still was very awkward, like switching back and forth. Just even having the ability to switch back and forth. Like, I've always asserted that I'm going to write this and target one environment, right? Whether that's full or core or whatever. And like, I'm never going to change after that. Well, not never, but certainly in my, initial phase building the application. But I guess that explains, because the one issue that I took up in the previous episode was the templates, right? We have two templates. So as a developer opening up the new tooling in Visual Studio, well, the full tooling's not out yet, but the current tooling right now, I say file new web project and I get two options, two templates, .NET Core, .NET Full. And I had mentioned on the show, I actually did that and did a diff. And the only difference was basically in the .NET Core one, it's bringing the framework down as a package. And the yep. .NET Full one, it's just adding an app config.
Yep.
So I guess that does answer the question, is that was because you removed the other tooling kind of in the application after you've already created it.
Yep.
And chosen to make that choice up front, which that makes a lot of sense. But I still have the same question of, how do I make the choice? And if I'm not really fully aware of how to switch between them, I feel like that is a very permanent choice.
Right? And, like, and you're right. In this version of the preview version of the tooling, it does feel very permanent. But as you've pointed out, we're just changing a couple of package references, we're pointing to a different framework, we're introducing another config file, and we can flip-flop between the two. So the tooling is coming.
It's a blog post, following a blog post to go and flip between them. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And, but I guess, the issue that I have is just the like fear of choice at that point. Like, how do I know which one I want to choose as I'm starting out?
Sure.
And I guess that comes down to whether or not I want to choose .NET Core or .NET Full, right?
Right.
And the seven tenants and all of that?
Exactly. So you're either going to know what .NET Core is, or you're going to know what .NET Framework is, and you're going to choose to do one or the other. But don't forget, we still have this concept of the one ASP.NET template dialog that pops up after you choose one of those, where then you have to choose your application template. So we want to get that consolidated down to one choice so that you can have that very descriptive dialogue that pops up and says, okay, how do you want your application structured? Which framework version do you want to use? And we have some nice friendly text there to walk the less experienced developer through some of those choices that they might not be familiar with. And they haven't built many applications with these tools. And none of us have built many applications with this yet. But as we get in there and we get experienced, it's going to be secondhand knowledge to us. Real quick, we'll be able to go through bang, 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 and we're off and running with our project. And really, how many times do you start a new project when you're being productive, right? It's, for the most part, these things are set it and forget it type things. And then there's a number of those things that are out there right now in the framework that people are pointing to, and they're like, oh my gosh, what do I do with this? It's set it and forget it. It's a configuration file. You configured it once. You might come back and add a few configuration options to it later, but for the most part, you're done with it for a few weeks at least.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to kind of step back, talk a little bit more about .NET Standard. One of the questions I have is, let's say I'm building some kind of utility library, and I wanted to use it on two different projects. One's going to be full, one's going to be core. Do I just now compile that as a BCL? Like, what is the... Do I have that ability?
As a portable class library?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, PCL. Yes. Is that what I would need to do for that shared code?
So the old portable class library, when you would compile it, right, you had to choose, you had this checkbox menu that would pop up, and you had to choose between a bunch of different frameworks. And it always startled me first time I saw that dialogue, because one of the first options is Xbox. And I was always like,
I can go.
Yeah. All right. I'm building.
Hello, world.
I'm building Fallout 4. Here we go. The challenge with using the old portable class library model is you end up with that checkbox, which determines your target frameworks that you're going to be compatible with, which then determines how you plug into .NET Standard. Because the way that the former portable class library structure worked, you ended up with the least common denominator of features across those things that you checked. Versus in the .NET Standard model, you end up with the most common set of features across all of those things that you've checked, right? You get everything that's available, and in those frameworks that don't support it, you should get some sort of an error message or some sort of a silent failure that, oh, this doesn't work on this environment. So the answer for should I build this with the old PCL or with something different depends on which ones you're targeting. Because the old portable class library model won't land with all of the frameworks, so you may end up like some of the other packages out there, popular packages that really tried to target everything. You may end up having to put together several different projects that are specifically targeted to different frameworks, but sharing code within those projects. So the answer is maybe, And it depends on what your needs are. So
it depends.
It's the golden rule of all software development. It depends.
And the idea of net standard is to get to a place where new platforms can come out and your code should still work. I don't have to go run and release a new version.
Right. So when that next framework comes out, it's .NET for rocks.
Yeah, right.
Right. I don't know because someone has an IoT rock that they keep in their garden. I don't know.
Sooner or later, we will.
Yeah. And there's a new API.
Is it raining or not?
Like, you know, wedging into the dirt deeply or whatever.
Absolutely. Sure. Digging. But you can say that .NET for rocks adheres to .NET Standard 1.3 and has these other APIs available for humidity, temperature, whatever else, other things. But it adheres to and understands .NET Standard 1.3. So all that code that you wrote for .NET Standard 1.3 that works great with your iPhone, with your Windows desktop, with your ASP.NET 4.6 project will also work inside your IoT rock. Make sense? So you're absolutely right, Chris. You end up just getting that next environment for free because it adheres to the standard.
Yeah, I can still use like Newtonsoft JSON with my new .NET rock. Hey, that's almost...
There you go.
It's almost close to a different... different yeah, sorry. So okay. Full framework, the term full framework. It's been hard to find standard terminology. And I know that even .NET Core... is not, when a developer thinks about the .NET framework, they think about you go and you get a web installer and then you install it and it becomes part of your system. It melds into your server or your desktop or your laptop or whatever. But .NET Core isn't
250 meg later.
Yeah. And .NET Core isn't quite like that. And then it's become very hard to Google because I've heard some folks using the term full framework. And I think, I don't know if that's going to be impossible to Google too.
So one of the terms that we use internally for it is the desktop framework, because it's the framework that you get on your desktop, and it also works on the server. It's the same framework. It's installed on the Windows desktop.
Yeah, and you're getting this cruft like WPF support on your cloud based server, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
It's the Windows framework.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, when I was debugging a web forms application, ASP.NET web forms application last week, and I looked at my call stack and references, and for some reason XAML is in there. I'm like, what the heck is this doing here?
It wasn't Windows.
But it's there. No, it's there because it's part of that full framework.
It's part of the runtime.
So exactly.
So .NET Core performance. We landed on this for a while, and one of the things we put in our show notes the pointer directly to the benchmarks page because there are some hard numbers being put there now.
Yep.
And if you go, you guys are actually running kind of your own tests and putting it right alongside popular frameworks. Mm-hmm. What frameworks are you comparing yourselves to, and maybe even why those were chosen?
Okay, so the benchmarks that you see out there here at the end of July 2016, these are the benchmarks that are on the GitHub.com ASP.NET benchmarks repository. The data that's there right now it hasn't been updated in about 2 or 3 months. You can see the machine definitions that are there. There's a complete outline of, here's the specifications of what our lab looks like that the developers are using. And this is what the developers are using with those performance tests that we've outlined there. This is, a dev team's tools. Quite literally, they've taken their old desktops and repurposed them as their test lab. So, great ingenuity. They got this up and running. They bought a nice fat piece of network hardware so that they could run some of these tests. So the question of, why did we choose some of these frameworks that are being compared to on there? Some of them are because we hear customers say, oh, I'm not going to use .NET anymore. I'm going to go use Node.js.
Node.js. Node, yeah.
is a big one that we've heard folks say, oh, I'm going to go use Node.js. And that's great. You're welcome to go use Node.js. But the prevailing reason that folks say they're going to Node.js is because they want to use JavaScript front and on the front browser side and also server side. And we also hear people say it's performance, the performance of a single-threaded web server. Okay?
Right.
You know, so let's break that down and take a look and see how we compare to that and what performance really is in concrete numbers in order for us to compete. And that's really what we're trying to do, is we're trying to compete, and so that, right? I mean, who wouldn't go look at their competitors and say, okay, well, how do we compete better with these competitor products? And that's exactly what the team is doing. We want to measure. We want to take measurements and then figure out how to make it better from there. And you can see those numbers. They're great numbers out there that you can compare to. And we took it one step further and we started comparing with these Tech Empower benchmarks. And I can give you guys a link you want to put in the show notes that points out to those. But we started looking at that and saying, okay, how do we really get into the conversation here and get in the top 10?
Right.
And we looked at what's involved with setting up a comparable lab. And Tech Empower runs on some crazy hardware, 24 processors, tons of RAM. There's a definition as to what their machines are on their website. But we wanted to compare apples to apples there. And when you take a look at it, what the guys have in our dev lab is actually about a third of the power that they're using, a third to a quarter of the power of what they're using on the Tech Empower benchmarks. So we took the exact same tests that Tech Empower uses, ran it against our frameworks, including ASP.NET 4.6, and got some baselines, and used the other frameworks and tried to use the exact same tests that those folks submitted for Tech Empower to measure, and developed these baselines you can see on GitHub. And then they started tinkering. How do we make the web host faster? And you can see they've made some significant advancements. In the dev lab, they see about 1.1 million requests a second, according to the current numbers that are posted there. At RTM, I think they were closer to 1.5 million requests per second in the dev lab. And when you scale that up and you take it to Microsoft's performance lab, which is the same size as the Tech Empower, but this is a performance lab that's, you know, more general purpose, but we strapped ASP.NET in there and took a look at it, we're seeing now about 5 million requests per second. And those benchmarks and that source code and tests have been submitted to Tech Empower. They haven't yet published their new round of results.
Yeah.
I think they're a little confused because they're seeing something that runs on Windows come through there. And if you look at all of the benchmarks out there, every single one of them is running on Linux. Every single one.
Right. In fact, the ASP.NET stuff previously was on Mono in their list when they still used to have it in the list.
And to be perfectly frank, ASP.NET running on Mono is a bad idea because Mono is more designed for client-side interactions. Yeah.
Right.
So we're waiting for the next round of their benchmarks to be published that came from their machines running the same tests that we believe we've emulated, and we'll be able to concretely say we're at 5 million requests per second on the benchmarks, and that puts us number X out there. Now, to be clear, the Node.js benchmark that's on the Tech Empower list for the last release that's out there as of this recording is from February 2016. Node.js records about 300,000 requests per second. And on comparable hardware with the same test, ASP.NET is clocking in at about 5 million requests per second. So we think we've got that performance thing addressed for right now. We do
now
have
some
folks...
Kestrel.
That is, so.
And we should probably talk about what Kestrel is.
Yeah. All right. So the ASP.NET 1.0 web server is called Kestrel, right? It's a very fast, minimal web server that is designed to handle ASP.NET and run on any environment, right? Linux, Mac, Windows, be able to develop against it. But at the same time, we're not certifying it for edge web surfing. We don't think you should put this directly on the internet, and you should use a strategy like you do, like you would use with Express, the web server for Node.js, where you should really reverse proxy your requests that come in. Stand up an Nginx or Apache web server in front of that, or an IIS, an Internet Information Server, in front of it, and turn around and reverse proxy those requests to Kestrel. It'll work great for you. We have people who have great success running in that configuration.
So when I'm a Windows developer and I learn how to use ASP.NET Core and Visual Studio, I'm going to assume like the templates and everything even kind of guide me to getting it running on IIS.
Yep.
Is that by default I'm getting that reverse proxying to Kestrel?
Yes. So when you do look at the IIS configuration that comes in Visual Studio 2015, Update 3, there is a web config in the default templates. And in that web config, it configures, I believe it's called the ASP.NET Core Module. It's gone through several different names, but I think the current name is the ASP.NET Core Module, and it's the only module in that web config. All that's doing is setting up that reverse proxy so that when IIS receives a request, it hands it off to the .NET runtime, the .NET CLI that's hosting Kestrel, that's hosting your application.
Yeah, there it is, the ASP.NET Core Module, and it's a handler for every verb, every path.
By default.
Right. The ASP.NET Core Module here that's sitting in the handlers and web config, That's the guy that knows how to proxy back to Kestrel.
Yep. It bootstraps the .NET command line interface to start it up, run your application, and send requests over to that service.
Okay. Because one thing I will say I was unsure of is I always saw in presentations and talks and in the awesome ASP.NET community standup was, oh, we've got Kestrel, high performance. And but here you write this line of code and now you're running an IIS. And I said, whoa, do I have to choose? And how would I choose? But it sounds like it's not really a choice. It's that Windows developers would probably proxy back from IIS, probably. But they wouldn't have to, I guess.
No. You could stand up Apache, you could stand up Nginx, you can stand up whatever you want in front of it. But you're going to want to stand something up in front of it.
Okay.
Kestrel doesn't know how to do caching. Kestrel doesn't know how to do SSL. So there are things here that you expect in a production grade web server that Kestrel doesn't know how to do because it's so focused on just ASP.NET.
Is that a common story for web developers who live mostly in Linux?
I think it is.
Okay.
I think we see that with Rails. I think we see that with Express, right? Because you have to add in those features you need. But really, to get the security, to get some of the other things that you want to layer on top of this, right? Transport layer security is very important. But as a programmer, that's a concern that happens at operations time.
Okay.
Let that happen over there.
Yeah. Well, even in the ASP.NET world, this was just installed and configured when you installed the full framework, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I in the previous episode, I took the very controversial stance that performance doesn't matter. Not really. But really that ASP.NET is an incredibly popular framework today already. ASP.NET full, right? Has been for a long time. My assertion is that it wouldn't be so popular if it was really poor performing. So obviously I'm not saying that performance doesn't matter. Everybody always wants performance. I frankly get frustrated whenever we discuss performance because it always seems to be like as developers, we just want everything to be fast, fast, fast. Even though, you know, I got the Static Void podcast website, which gets maybe 500 hits a day, right? That doesn't need to be fast. I've got a medium-sized business website, which gets a couple hundred, couple thousand, couple 10,000, 100,000 hits a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would assume that is the bulk of the world. And then you get into, you know, Etsy, and we're talking serious customizations and stuff there to and just flat out network infrastructure, right? Like, forget about the framework. It's the network infrastructure that's helping handle that kind of load. So I'm not saying it doesn't matter. I'm saying that the performance of ASP.NET Full has always been really good. So it, when it comes back to the question of why would I pick or why would I choose to invest in moving toward core over full when I'm so comfortable with full, that's kind of another one of those tenets that's just kind of not for me, right? And I'm really kind of questioning how many people is that really relevant to, truly relevant to?
So all right, this was going to bake your noodle, but I agree with you that for 98% of the developers out there, you're right, performance doesn't matter. And I'll explain that with a caveat. In the benchmarks that you saw out there on the GitHub repository, ASP.NET 4.6 with MVC is pulling down 50,000 requests per second. If you have more than 50,000 people hitting your website at once,
yeah,
I mean, literally, simultaneously, 50,000 right. people.
Awesome okay, problem to have.
That's an amazing problem to have. Yeah. You now need to start thinking bigger.
Yeah.
But, okay, if you've got 50,000 people hitting your website simultaneously, put it out on Azure.
Yeah.
Now, you're still paying probably the same amount, if not a little bit less, to run your application because you're renting server time from Microsoft. Yeah. But as soon as you need 100,000 requests per second, it's a slider.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
You're paying twice as much as you were for the service because now you've got two instances
right.
or whatever your contract may be. And you can, right, you've got a good problem now because now you're handling 100,000 requests and it costs you zero development time.
Right.
But this is the difference in do I go out and do I buy a Honda Civic that has four cylinders? And you know what? Those guys in the Fast and the Furious or the Need for Speed who know how to trick that out, put yeah. nitrous on it and right, put the turbocharger on it and the big gnarly fin on the back and the afterburner with the flame right. shooting out the tailpipe.
Right,
the guys
right.
who know how to customize that, and they are brilliant people, and they can customize that and they can make that thing do 200 miles an hour and it's a freaking Honda Civic.
uh-huh.
That's great. You can do that. And you know what? They've invested the time and money, and they have the knowledge to do that. And you know what? I have no doubt that the four of us on this podcast have done something similar.
Right.
Maybe not with a Honda Civic, but right. maybe with some web content. But you can do that. Or, you know what? I've got a couple bucks. At the time that I'm getting started here, I can go out and instead of choosing the Honda Civic, I can get, you know what, the Honda, what is it, CRV? What's their sports model? I forget what it's called, right? But it's eight cylinders, and it does the exact same thing. It's about the same size and shape. It's only two seats, but to start, even though I only need to go 25 miles an hour around town, driving the kids to school and church and wherever, great. But when you need to get out on the highway, you can do 120 without blinking. And I think that's what we're seeing is there's some executive comparisons where people are picking up the latest copy of CIO magazine and saying, hey, did you see what the folks are saying over here about PHP? I saw that Facebook movie over here, and he wrote the whole Facebook in PHP. Maybe we should write our website in PHP.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's good for Facebook, and that's a $2 billion company. Yeah. But they don't get some of the inherent things yeah. that come with that, where it's clear to me, Jess, from your question, that you see the productivity that you have with .NET. ASP.NET yeah. is easy to get started with. You can be productive. And you know what? If you do get that high performance coming out of it without having to invest in more servers, great.
Yeah.
It's yeah. no less that you've had to think about or worry about. And that's why I say, look at your greenfield applications to do that. And at the same time, I agree with you that the performance doesn't really matter because I can flip the switch. And if it costs me less to add another server on Azure than it does for my developers to start tuning for performance, add another server on Azure.
Yeah.
It's like it always does. So
yeah.
Or whoever your cloud provider may be.
But your point is that it still does cost more, maybe not as much as development time. But
right, and yeah. that cost and how you realize it is a discussion you need to have with your accounting folks to make sure that it fits your business needs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And this is one of those arguments that I just say it and then I walk away, right? Like, I'm not willing to put my stake in the ground and fight it. I just it's one of those things that I have to point out just because it is one of those seven tenets. Like, and it seems to be the first or second thing that anybody always says, this is the reason, right? It's small, it's fast. I just feel like we as developers, just as a race, we always want everything to be as fast as possible, and I just always question that mentality. Like, that's not the most important thing.
No, it's not. It's not, but it is one of those things. That
nice to have.
It's a nice to have. And when you're making a decision at the start, why work harder to get something that's in the box?
I think that's the important thing. Agree. Being in the box helps sell the idea of switching. Or moving it over.
Yes. And Kestrel is now the server. So Kestrel is delivered as a package. Kestrel can be updated and enhanced without deploying a new version of Windows, because the only web server you could use with ASP.NET 4.6 and earlier is IIS. Mm-hmm. So we can update Kestrel in the future, mm-hmm. make it faster, make it better.
Yes.
And all you have to do is update a package.
Yep, that is huge. Well, and vice versa. If you wanted to update your server, you're inherently updating IIS, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I have those problems. Mm. Right now, I have those problems.
Yeah, if you're updating IIS and you host multiple web applications, well, are they all going to work? Mm-hmm. Well, now we can deliver the framework and the web server completely isolated in its own folders, and that application does not affect any of the other application folders next to it.
Right. So you're Fantastic. Talking about the first tenet that you mentioned, which is the modularity, which I love.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, I absolutely love that. Totally behind that.
And the corollary to that is the portability of it. Great. I've only added in these couple things, and it's sitting here in this folder, but I can copy that folder onto a USB stick, take it over to my Mac, and it still works.
Yep. So I want to shift the conversation a little bit. I keep making I keep saying the phrase, making the assertion that there is a lot to learn when you're moving from, I have been doing ASP.NET, classic ASP.NET, full ASP.NET for, 10 years, right? Or even folks
selling me a Coca-Cola here.
Yeah. We're going to coin it right here, right?
I've invested. I know, right? And the assertion I was making on the last episode is that there is a lot to learn. There's a lot to invest in learning this. So clearly, that's true with any new framework. Just figuring out what's here and what's there, right? What's the difference between what's new, what's existing, and all this stuff. One of the big kind of selling points, or at least certainly not one of the seven tenets, but one of the things that it seems like the team is saying to really kind of calm developers down, is that it's concept compatible, right? In today's world, you have the HTTP context, you have the request, the response, you got the user object. They're all there. They're all right where you expect them to be. My assertion that I made in the last episode is that sometimes that can be dangerous, right? So there's two sides to this kind of line of discussion. One of them is, how much does it, in your opinion, how much time do I really need to invest to go from, I know ASP.NET for 5 years, I'm very well acquainted with it, to getting really up and running and, quote, knowing, like being really productive and knowing ASP.NET Core. And then also with this concept compatibility, I feel like off the bat, it sounds like a really good thing, but it can really get you into trouble when you go to use that user object or that request object and you go to use it in the way that you've been used to using it for the past 5 years, but it's another type. It just looks a lot like the one that you're used to, right? And so it starts acting a little differently. And at that point, it might have just been better for it to be a completely different object in API that you relearned from scratch.
So, so let's break that down. How long does it take you to get productive in the new ASP.NET Core? I would submit to you that really the big things that have changed is the introduction of middleware. Now, we had middleware with Owen back in ASP.NET 4.6, but this middleware is a little bit different, and now everything is middleware. There are no HTTP modules and handlers. You need to configure those things that intercepted the pipeline as middleware in ASP.NET Core. So if you had a bunch of that previously, if you want to write some of that, you've got some learning to do to make that happen. But it's a pretty straightforward API. And very easy to get into and figure your way around so you can tune and deliver what you need. But for 80%+ of the folks that are out there that are going to be writing ASP.NET applications, you're not going to be building your own middleware.
Right.
You're not going to be building your own security layer. Please don't build your own security layer.
Yes. Right. Yes.
That is various kind of synonymous to HTTP modules today, right? So
yes.
What you might write an HTTP module for in the full framework, that's what you're writing a kind of piece of middleware. It's a part of the pipeline now.
Right.
We have this concept of a pipeline in ASP.NET mm-hmm. today. It's just not middleware. It's not a first-class citizen.
No, it's a series of event handlers on modules that are loaded and they get randomly fired off
right.
as a request comes in. That same onload event triggers in all of the modules, and you don't know if your module loaded and hit that before the other module over there.
Yeah,
well,
right.
Okay. So the configuration of your pipeline is something that if you're doing something that's a little bit beyond some of the standard things that are out there in the templates, yeah, it's going to take you a little bit to figure out. Routing in MVC is very much the same as it was before, with a couple of enhancements to make things a little bit easier to work with. But it's something that you should be able to pick up pretty quickly. There's some samples that go with it, and routing is one of those things that you're not going to be tinkering with. Like I was saying earlier, you're not going to be tinkering with it with every page that you write. You're going to have mm-hmm. pretty much a standard that you throw out there, maybe a couple enhancements that you drop into the mix every now and again. But for the most part, you're going to set it and forget it. But then when you get into your controllers, right, and your views, Razor looks like Razor.
Right.
There's the new tag helpers concept, but you don't have to use it. And that's fine. You can use HTML helpers just the way they were. And that works great. You don't have to use the new web API and MVC controller functionality that have been merged in the same controller file. That's up to you. Put these down however you'd like. It's about choice. You don't have to take all of these features if you don't want them. There are some new things to learn around security. And speaking with our security folks, they're very proud and they're very happy with how our security story has been delivered and how stable it is. It's very good. The ability to create roles and policies and enforce those works great. But it's going to take a little bit of learning to understand how that runs, and that'll probably take you half a day to go through. Fortunately, we've got good tutorial out there, some good documentation around that, so that you can learn it and really apply it to your application. But once again, security and these things, configuring it is something you're going to do once and forget, and then you're going to start decorating things with your authorized attributes and which policy you want to be out there, and it feels similar to what you were doing before. So the meat and potatoes of what you were doing of building Razor views that connect to controllers, or you're building web API elements with HTML out there and JavaScript that has Angular 2 with TypeScript out there, is still the same. The server-side interactions that you write on a daily basis, it's C#, it's still pretty much the same. You're right, the user object is different. You're right. HTTP context is different, but they're different because we optimize them to get rid of some of those old system web things that were clumsy in our modern perspective from 2016, looking back at what was built and needed to be compatible back to stuff that was written in 2001.
And also completely untestable.
And completely untestable. You're right.
The
new stuff is completely testable. There are XUnit unit tests for everything. There is dependency injection in every service class, in your Razor views too. So go for it. I think you could take less than a week to learn some of these configuration things that you may need to do more than that first time you start configuring your application. It may take you a little bit longer when you need to come back to it a month or two later. And, Skippy says, hey, we need to add functionality X to my application. But for the most part, you're going to get productive back in controllers and views and entity framework very, very quickly.
So that's totally fair. And I don't disagree with that statement in terms of productivity and using it. Creating new controllers, adding new functionality to the application, I don't necessarily disagree. And in fact, I did the lynda.com course, right? I had a lynda.com course on ASP.NET MVC 4, and then I'm currently recording the course for ASP.NET Core.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get into the guts of it when I get into controllers, views, you know, how to do data access and everything. All that is almost literally word for word, right? Yeah. I almost literally could take my script from the MVC 4.1, say, here's what a controller is, here's how to write a controller, you know, structure and action, here's what an action does. And you know, and some of it is literally, you know, even if it is a new namespace, it is the same properties and everything. It's when you kind of get into the guts that is right underneath the framework, because MVC, Web API, which doesn't exist anymore, and that's, I love that. You know, that's awesome. If it sounded like I was being critical, I'm not. That's awesome.
No.
But anything that runs on top of the core framework, those, and I assume SignalR will be the same when it's ready, right? Those, I think you'll develop almost literally exactly the same way you do today, but then you get onto ASP.NET that is actually running all of this stuff. That's the thing that was completely rewritten and
yep.
completely different. And productivity, you're using the framework on top of ASP.NET, right? So when we're talking about productivity, you're going to be productive in ASP.NET MVC. You're going to be productive in SignalR.
Yep.
When I'm talking about really, truly knowing it, using it, that is when you got to get down into the guts of it. Get down into ASP.NET and the things that I would have written an HTTP handler for, or an action filter, even an action filter, an MVC, or an HTTP module for, or even just the basic configuration of the site and startup of the site.
Mm-hmm.
That's the stuff you really have to learn, and you're going to be kind of pulling your hair out when you run into problems, right?
And I think you're right. That stuff is different. Without question, that stuff is different. And most of that stuff, yeah, is going to go untouched. You're right. When you do need to build that extra stuff, you're going to have to spend a little bit of time learning. I completely agree with you on that. And that's right, part of the learning of, you know, adapting to a new framework. But the fortunate part, absolutely. MVC, Web API, the code is still the same. You don't have to learn a new programming language here. Just some new objects when you go to configure the ASP.NET framework, not the MVC display framework.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's just the difference is that right now I know how the ASP.NET pipeline works,
yep.
right? I've spent hundreds of hours, thousands of hours probably at this point, and I know when the page load is going to happen and all those events, and even the events that are underneath the web
mm-hmm.
forms in ASP.NET Core, right? I know that when I want to add this piece of functionality, I'm going to add an HTTP module or an HTTP handler. I know which one to choose, right?
Sure.
So all of that is just completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
And when you move over, any HTTP modules, handlers that you've written previously, they need to be probably completely rewritten.
Yes.
If not, you know, just at least copied and ported, meaning drastically changed, but, you know.
Not as drastically as you might think, right? I mean, you lose the event yeah. handlers, but you're going to consolidate it down into a piece of middleware that knows exactly when it was called.
Yes.
You're going to position that middleware in the pipeline exactly where you need it, so you know
yeah.
what happened before it, and you know what's going to happen after it because of its position in the pipeline. Which kind of makes all those events unnecessary because really it's handle what's happening right now.
So you've released RTM, right? We have a 1.1 version, which is great. The roadmap, what's coming next? Where is the best place to get this information?
So currently there's a roadmap that was posted to the .NET blog that was written by the director, head of all of .NET right now. That's Scott Hunter. There's information there about here's what's planned. There's a 1.01 release that's planned for an August timeframe. There is additional features that we plan to release before year end, and then other things that we want to do in the Q1, Q2 2017 timeframe. So it's prescribed, but it's you know, these are line items with these are the things we want to accomplish. It is not a full specification of here's exactly what we mean by this thing, because we're still trying to figure out some of those things. And those items are slowly being turned into GitHub issues where discussion and further planning is occurring.
Gotcha. So that blog post would be the best place to go, and if you wanted to have a better idea of what's coming.
Yep, for right now, that would be where I would go.
We talked a lot about ADO.NET.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we opened up the code right on GitHub in the CoreFX repo
mm-hmm.
and said, look, there's a system.data.sql client. Okay. And it looks like all of our old friends are here. Maybe that means that we could at least do some of the SQL you know, the data reader stuff that we would be used to. Maybe I want to port something that uses ODBC. So now I at least want to get involved in the discussion of what might come back.
Mm-hmm.
Is that look for the issue? Is that kind of conversation? Is that expected?
So this is right. This is a question of how do you get involved? How, right? When does the conversation happen? How do you get involved, if at all? And
right.
What impact does that have? How do things change in advance? And the answers for those things really are, and you guys are already doing some of this. The big high level items are being called out on the blogs as we're working on them, and you're going to see a lot more status blog posts and planning blog posts coming out from us. The .NET blog and the web dev blog are going to have lots more of that information as we go along, because we want to be transparent with how the product is evolving. We want you, our stakeholders, our developers, our customers, to know here's how things are evolving and changing. The challenge that we're having is there are so many moving pieces in this that everybody wants all these different pieces to happen right now. And unfortunately, right, there's a priority to these things. We've, you know, this is dependent upon that, and there's, you know, other dependencies that are in play, and we of course have our corporate requirements. Hey, we need to be able to support when, you know, SQL Server 2016, when that becomes available and it's running on Linux and it's running on Windows, we need to make sure that all of these things for that product as a corporate mandate happen. Right. And there's other things along those same lines. Right. We want to make sure we have a great story with how to work with code with Xamarin. Right. You've already seen these things. We talked about that a little bit with .NET Standard. So those planning things are going into effect before it even comes to the .NET Core discussion and even gets to GitHub. Those decisions have already been made. And those things that you see on the roadmap, those are the things that are possible for coming up for discussion that we want to deliver. And because you guys are plugged in, because you guys are seeing the open source repositories, because you're reading the blogs, you're going to see when those discussions happen. You're going to see links to those discussions on GitHub, and that's where you're going to jump in. You can certainly create your own issue out there that says, hey, you know what? We're missing feature X that I really loved because I loved being able to do this, right? I really enjoyed having a SQL data source that I could put on my web form. I want a SQL data source on my MVC page. I don't know. I'm just making this up. If you want a SQL data source on your Razor sheet, more power to you. I've seen people write SQL on their Razor sheets, and that's not the way we like the architecture to be built, but no. More power to you. But if that's,
I would recommend against that.
That's the architecture show.
But, yeah, exactly. But if that's a feature that you want, go for it. Go out to that Razor repository, create that issue, start that conversation, because somebody will respond to you. They might say, no, we're not building that. That's right. Always a possibility. I mean, Microsoft is not going to say, yes, we're going to go build that, and we're going to go build it right now to every single request.
Right.
We've only got so many developers working for us. But it's an open source repository. It's an open source project. You can build those things, and if it's something that Microsoft really likes, you can submit it, and it might be added to the core framework. But then again, you could also publish it as your own NuGet package, and now you've got static void dot razor dot SQL data source NuGet package out there, and you could put your SQL data source on Razor pages and be happy as a clam, and everybody can access it.
Oh, we already decided a couple episodes ago. Our the name of our framework is Shazam.
That's right, that's, Shazam. That's I forgot format. About that. Right, Shazam.razor.sql data source.
I guarantee we're not making a SQL data source.
That's right. ODBC data source. You're right, Todd. I forgot.
No, it won't be a data source. Driver.
But it's right. There is support for you to be able to extend the framework and do these things. The question of does it get included in that framework that everybody gets is a whole nother story. But you are more than welcome to build the features you need and publish them as your own NuGet package that has that feature in it.
Yep. So that was one of the points that I brought up in the previous episode, too, is that I think the issue that you took with the previous episode, the one that had you screaming at your radio in your car, was when I was basically saying, by the time I'm learning all of this stuff,
yep,
why don't I just jump to Node, right? Which
yeah.
It might have been a little bit of trolling, but my point was I was following the logical kind of conclusion of, okay, I'm already learning a bunch of stuff, right? So you may not be changing ASP.NET MVC on me. That mm-hmm. might be perfectly, for the sake of argument, let's say that's exactly the same. Even though it's not true, it's true enough.
It's close enough for government work.
Close enough, yeah. You're completely changing ASP.NET Core. Concept compatible, but not the same, right? So by the time I'm really needing to understand the guts and understand middleware, and if you've kind of dabbled in Node a little bit, you kind of know that the middleware, that's exactly how Node applications are written as well, with the concept of middleware, or at least Express applications. Why wouldn't I just go to Node? Not just because it is popular, but because it hits a lot of those same tenets, right? So what I said in the last episode was, you know, it already is cross-platform, and in fact, it's a very mature cross-platform. Not only that, I'm writing in JavaScript, which I'm already writing in the browser because I'm writing a web app, right? Just a bunch of these other things that, like, it's not just, hey, I got to learn a whole bunch of stuff. Why don't I take this opportunity to switch to another framework? I'm calling out Node in particular because it really hits a lot of these same tenets.
So right? I would disagree that Node is very mature. I'll agree that it does a lot of, you know, it does a lot of these tenets very, very well. But I can't in good faith say that a framework is very mature when it's iterating and there's new versions of all kinds of base level things more frequently than every 3 months.
Yeah.
It is evolving so quickly that nobody can reliably build tooling or build any kind of reference that's going to last 6 months with, you know, with the core things that are happening over on Node. And the stuff that is evolving and happening in Node is amazing. There is a community there that is absolutely amazing. Don't get me wrong. I think they're doing a tremendous job there. It's a great example of how the open source technical community can really accomplish something cool. But there are folks that are building enterprise applications that they're not going to touch for 10 years.
Yeah, but aren't we at the same phase with ASP.NET Core?
Well, we're at a 1.0 release of ASP.NET Core. Or you could certainly build something and bet on it for the next 10 years, and you know what? Microsoft is going to support you. But in an open source community like Node, you're going to gamble on this and say, I'm going to build this, and your base class library for Node is npmjs.com.
Yeah, well, and that was kind of my point, right? Is by the time you're going out to the internet and getting packages,
mm-hmm.
even in the new world of ASP.NET Core or .NET Core for that mm-hmm. matter, by the time you're going out and getting packages and you're saying, "Go and get me Shazam framework,"
mm-hmm.
those packages live on, you just said npmjs.org, they live on NuGet.org, right? And so my package, Shazam, is living right next to Microsoft's official package.
That's right.
And as a developer, the only way I know to get one over the other is just because I know that, you know, the Microsoft one is the one that I want. But
sure.
By the time I'm going out to NuGet to get all my packages, like, what does it matter if it's given by Microsoft or a really, really popular and mature framework like JSON.NET?
Absolutely.
Right? Which is now a core part of my application, mm-hmm. and it's not delivered by Microsoft. But it's that same kind of community problem. I feel like you were presenting it earlier as a problem, but, you know, the community is giving a lot of these packages, and I think we're going to see that more and more, that we're going to rely less on Microsoft packages for our core and more on community stuff.
So to be clear, the problem that I perceive with Node, that I perceive, this isn't Microsoft, this is Jeff Fritz perceives, is that the community packages, there is such a high percentage of community packages that drive that Node ecosystem. And yes, there are thousands of them that are literally one line of JavaScript.
Right.
Quite literally.
They're modular, right?
Absolutely.
Number one, they're modular.
There's five times as many lines of code in the unit tests And right. And when they compile their packages to deploy, they're actually bigger than they were if you just downloaded the JavaScript directly right. in some cases. Right. In some cases, right. not all cases, right? And right. and this is a, you know, I'm picking on one or two packages in that I have in mind in particular. But the point that I'm making is those things evolve very, very rapidly. And there are changes that are not backwards compatible that happen with the JavaScript. There are support things that are happening inside the JavaScript community where they're just dropping support for something that was written a year ago. And yeah. tough luck on you. Now, okay, it's JavaScript. You have all the source code for it. Theoretically, you could continue to support that old version of Angular if that was what you wanted, and the Angular folks had discontinued support. I'm picking on Angular here. This hasn't really happened. But you do have all of the source code because it is JavaScript. It's all clear text that's sitting there. You can't really hide it. Okay.
Right.
So there's the first problem. The other problem is the JavaScript community is they believe in complete freedom with these packages, and as we saw with the Leftpad incident, they can remove these packages at will.
Right. Well, yeah.
So
I feel like that's just a problem with npm.js, right? That's something that could be fixed,
but npm
currently is a legitimate problem.
Right. Npm is now is a cornerstone to the Node community. You can't avoid it. You need to install stuff from npm, but. Yes. Conversely, as NuGet moves into that role, NuGet.org moves into that role, that's managed and sponsored by the .NET Foundation. That is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to the enhancement and support of the .NET community.
Yeah.
They are not going to, and they're working very hard to provide the level of security, consistency, and continuity on that NuGet.org service that we need to rely on for the next 10 years.
Yeah. And that is a good selling point, but isn't this ultimately kind of, we're talking specifically about Node.js, but this is really any open source ecosystem, right? So basically you're talking about, you've got the full weight of Microsoft behind you and you're not going to lose support for it. But I guess when we're talking about a really popular package like JSON.NET, but Microsoft mm-hmm. is supporting JSON.NET, right?
That's correct. As part of the .NET Foundation, yes.
Right. So that's a bad example. Some other really popular frameworks that I can't think of right now that don't fall under the doc. Yeah, right. It's the same story with them, right? I mean, I guess
yep,
that's why
absolutely.
You choose one framework over the other. Yeah. So if you care about that.
Yep.
But I guess my point, my rambling is really getting to the point of, you know, there's a very vibrant Ruby community. There are plenty of vibrant communities that are built off open source where there just really isn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And folks who go to .NET and really care about the support are, it just isn't really a problem in those other ecosystems.
Yep.
I don't know. That's just my opinion. I guess you're saying that would be one of the selling points. It's not really a debate. I'm not saying it's not a selling point.
So there you go.
So, Jeff, you brought this up earlier on about Visual Studio 15. You can just kind of talk real quick. I mean, it's a little confusing now because we have Visual Studio 2015, and there's also Visual Studio 15. Going mm-hmm. back to the idea of the core, is 15 going to support both 4.6.2, I guess, and then core, and that's what we're supposed to be using moving forward? Like, what is the difference?
What is the difference between Visual Studio 15 and Visual Studio 2015?
Yeah, I guess that's basically my question.
Okay, so Visual Studio 15, because 15's one more than 14, and Visual Studio 2015 was codenamed Dev 14, right? Because
right.
when we installed the previews for that.
Or is it, can we expect a name change, or is it going to remain the name this time?
I think they're calling it Visual Studio Shazam.
Yeah,
right. No, we had the copyright.
There you go. Quick, go get that domain name.
Yes.
It is a code name right now. Absolutely. Okay. They do plan on changing that. I do not work in marketing, but I can point to the other Visual Studio names and I can guess it's going to be named something similar.
Sure. Right, right. Like we can read the tea leaves or there's a seismic marketing shift coming. and none of us know about it, so.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Or are privy to disclose it in the public. Anyways, the big thing is this Project Willow that you're seeing come out. It's the installer where, if you saw the demos from Build, there's some great videos out there where the folks at Build are installing this, and it installs in less than a minute.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. To have a rich editor that supports out of the box JavaScript, Python, and I think there's one or two other languages.
Yeah.
And you get that solution experience. And then we're going to start to layer in those .NET experiences, right? These other language experiences, these other project model experiences. And it's going to start to look and feel more like the existing Visual Studio that you have. The first and foremost change is that install experience. We want to make that as painless as possible. Because you know what? In downloading a 10 gig installer and then having to wait a few hours after you waited a few hours for that to download, for it to all install, is painful. And we've all seen it that have installed it.
Yeah.
And as somebody, as a program manager on the team, who's installed Visual Studio many, many times because I've gotten nightly builds.
It's a pain point, right?
Yeah, and it's not friendly to some scenarios that we've talked about, like if you're...
The hackathon scenario. I mean, how do you
sure,
give people,
yes,
hey, go install Visual Studio and we'll get off and running. Half your hackathon time is spent,
right,
installing Visual Studio.
Yep.
So,
right. Or sometimes when we teach people Unity and say, hey, you know, there's a great debugging experience in Visual Studio. Oh, none of you have that installed here, though. And
right,
no, you couldn't install it now, not in the next, especially to these non-developers who are picking up Unity. Some of them are just gamers who say, man, I think it's great to learn how to make a game. And you say, well, maybe go home and go get Visual Studio Community. And now you're asking them to figure that all out on their own, you know?
So... we're really looking forward to what's coming with 15. We're going to see more of our tooling get delivered here with .NET Core and ASP.NET Core, and that's something that I think, certainly from what I'm hearing from you guys, something that we're all looking forward to.
Yeah, without question.
And yeah, and it's going to complete that experience and really help us to resolve some of the lingering questions that we have and make it easier to use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I think is cool? I like the experience of, you know, download a couple things from the command line, especially over when you look at how the Linux install documentation is for .NET Core and ASP.NET Core. And then go get a simple text editor and boom, you're working. You get VS Code, you're debugging even. But I like that 0 to 60. It's certainly great for like a 10-minute YouTube video or something.
Yeah, it is.
So that's just my two cents on it. I love that. I think that is one of my favorite things about it, even if it's not like, you know, no one's really going to go to work and work that way. Although, you know, just saying that, I'm not saying that's really true. But for that experience of, hey, I want to show you how this works.
The speed to first application being written, right? Getting that good feeling of, hey, I've delivered something. I've got something running, right? That magic of I wrote some code and it works is very important to us.
Yeah, well, and so along with the tooling conversation, there's this whole CLI, right? The command line tooling that like we didn't even touch on, and we are out of time, like we can't talk about it now. But that's a really crucial part of that cross-platform experience, right? Like if you're really serious about cross-platform and you're looking at Docker and you're looking at even running on Linux or whatever, you're probably developing on a Mac maybe. Right?
Sure.
Or at least want to be able to, or that nice MacBook Pro that you have that you're currently running Windows on, maybe you want to be able to dual boot back into Mac for a while. I don't know why, because Windows is awesome, but the command line tooling and Visual Studio Code and other tools like that, that's a really crucial part of this whole conversation too. Right?
It goes back to one of those tenets of we're going to bring the tools to wherever the developers are.
Yeah.
And if you want to run on a Mac, here it is running on a Mac. I mean, I have a MacBook Air that I use that has stock OS X. I'm sorry, OS X, because that's how the Mac people say it, because I called their support line. It's OS X. Mm-hmm. And I will fight anybody who tells me it's OS X. So get in the octagon with me. Let's go. So I called their support, and I've got, you know, basically stock version of it with or whatever the latest install is. You know, I've just been doing the updates from the App Store and Office 365 and the .NET tools, and it runs great. And I don't need to put Windows down on it because I can do all that I need to do with Visual Studio Code.
Yeah, that, yeah. I mean, that's awesome. That's adding that to the ecosystem is this makes everything better. It's a good experience.
So that sounds like a show. So listener, what do you think? Do you have any more questions about what's coming? Are you excited to move to ASP.NET Core, or are you just going to stick around with the full framework for a little while longer? We'd love to know. Please leave a comment on the website, staticvoidpodcast.com, or send an email to comments@staticvoidpodcast.com. And as always, if you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss on the show, please feel free to let us know through those same channels. We'd love to hear what you want us to talk about. So Todd, Chris, thanks for the chat.
Yep, thanks.
And Jeff, thanks so much
for taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, it was fun.
I think we certainly, we covered a lot of area, and I think we cleared up a lot of questions. So thanks for taking the time.
All right, thank you.
And thank you, listener, for spending the time with us. We hope that you enjoyed it, and we look forward to seeing you next time on the Static Void Podcast.